74 degrees Kenosha, 70 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Before we get to today's morning show, I want to just mention something very special coming tomorrow in the podcast version of the morning show. From the archives, from the spring of 1999, a conversation with the great entertainment legend Steve Allen. One of the few interviews done on the morning show conducted by both myself and the other host of the morning show back then, WGTD News Director Bill Guy. A really special moment in morning show history, which will be heard on the Saturday podcast of The Morning Show. To subscribe to The Morning Show, make sure you look for the proper title, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's available through Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Again, that's tomorrow's podcast version of The Morning Show. And now for today's program here on WGTD. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. You're going to be hearing today from two novelists about two great thrillers. One newly published, the other published back in 2018. Both of them set in Russia, and both of them set in roughly the same time frame, the mid-1990s, around and shortly after the fall of the old Soviet Union. Here's part one.
I'm excited to be able to speak with novelist Josh Haven about a very intriguing book called The Siberia Job. And this is a book that is set during one of the most fascinating periods in recent world history, the mid-1990s, in the immediate wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And a scenario that a character in the book calls the Wild Wild West of the East, when the former Soviet Union and specifically Russia is in the process of privatizing what had been state industries. And it is, of course, a scenario, a setting in which a whole lot of people from the West entered with all kinds of big plans. And that's essentially the setting in which this really exciting novel takes place. And it's a novel that's not only based in general on this period in history, but also based very specifically on some incredibly dramatic and dangerous things that happened. We're going to be exploring all of that in just a moment with Josh Haven, who himself has a really interesting background, now a novelist, but for a while worked on physics. And he was, for a time, a production intern at Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, but now a novelist. This is his fourth book, his second crime thriller. And again, it is titled The Siberia Job. Josh Haven, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I have to ask you, first of all, this interesting resume that you have. I wonder if you can kind of draw any kind of a through line between Jimmy Fallon and physics and writing novels like The Siberia Job. I mean, have kind of the interesting things you've done before this in any way prepared you for what you're doing now? Or is this just a dramatic leap into another direction that has little or nothing to do with what you've done before?
Well, I guess there is kind of a through line. When I was in college, I wrote a spec script for 30 Rock, the TV show, which was then on the air. And a good friend of mine was dating a girl who is now his wife, who worked at Broadway Video, which produced 30 Rock and Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, Saturday Night Live, and all of those Lauren Michaels shows. And he gave her the script, and she read it and really liked it and said, "Would you like me to try to get an internship at 30 Rock?" And I said, "Of course." And then, a day later, she came back and said, "They've already hired all their interns for the year. How about Jimmy Fallon?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, that sounds fun." So at Jimmy Fallon, there was this box for everything that was mailed to the show that no one wanted. And I know I got an absinthe fountain that someone mailed to the show, and no one else at the show was willing to try to take home on the subway. I picked up a lot of like promotional footballs that were sent. I've got a set of those somewhere, and a lot of books, because people were always trying to get novelists on the show, but the show, as far as I know, never had a novelist on, at least not while I was there. So all of these books ended up in the free stuff pile. So I would take all the books home and I would read them and I would write reviews and I would send the reviews out to magazines. And that's how I got my first sort of paid writing jobs, was writing book reviews. And so I sort of did that in the background. I was working on trying to get into graduate school for astrophysics, because it had always been sort of a hobby of mine. And I'd written a few papers, sort of dilettantish stuff, but they had been reasonably well received, and I thought it would be fun to go to graduate school for astrophysics. But my degree, my bachelor's degree, was in playwriting, so it was a difficult sell. So I got to the wait list at Berkeley, but that was about it. So you know, go Golden Bears. I still feel very loyal to them for putting me on their wait list, but. At the same time, I was, you know, sort of looking for work and writing books kind of just to keep my hand in with writing. The day my now agent called me that he wanted to represent the book, I was actually looking into applying for a spot at a school for commercial truck drivers because I needed a job. So, but he ended up selling the book and things have been going pretty swimmingly ever since. So that's how I ended up here. I still kind of dream occasionally about going back into physics, just sort of, you know, to keep my eye on with that. But, you know, there are only so many things that one can pursue simultaneously. And the, you know, physics is kind of a full-time occupation, I guess, as is novel writing. So it's been an interesting few years.
No kidding. I'm curious to hear from you how you would compare writing novels with playwriting, which of course are somewhat related, and yet they're not exactly the same. In your mind, what is most different? And are there things about writing a novel that maybe you find more satisfying or more fun than playwriting?
Well, there definitely are, because certainly you can get much, much more in depth with a novel than you ever could with a play. There are as many plot points in the first two chapters of most novels as there are in an entire play, which has got to have a pretty tight three-act structure, you know, and move through things very quickly. But I think probably my novel writing was improved substantially by coming to it from playwriting, just because it gave me a sense of really keeping my novels moving along at a good clip, because there's no room for any fat, so to speak, on a play. And I think too many novels, I don't want to knock my fellow novelists, but certainly a lot of novels have a lot of sort of somewhat non-plot related filler content, which I've never really enjoyed reading. And I try not to write too much. And I think that sort of goes along with the you know, every word in a play has got to be doing something. Well, you know, as I say that, it sounds a little silly, because, of course, nothing happens in most contemporary plays. since Waiting for Godot, not much has been happening on the stage. But I sort of had the idea of getting into a playwright. I read Moss Hart's memoir when I was in high school, Act One. You know, Kaufman and Hart, and I sort of got into the whole Algonquin Roundtable memoir reading phase that I think a lot of young writers go through at some point. And you know, I really wanted to write sort of stage comedies of the sort that used to be very popular before everything moved to TV and movies. But you know, there's no market for that at all anymore. And at some point one has to make a living, which is why I moved into novels, where it seemed a little more practical that I might actually sell something eventually.
Right. In addition to the books like this, you have written some historical fiction. And in some respects, this new book, The Siberia Job, is kind of historical fiction, in the sense that it is not only set in a real place and real period, but it also is drawn from some real life events. Yeah. And your protagonist, John Mills, in the book is very closely patterned after somebody whom you met at some point. Tell our listeners about this real life encounter that you had, which I assume was the spark for you ultimately writing The Siberia Job.
It's based on a real businessman named John Kleinheitz, the book was actually his idea in a sense, because, well, not in a sense, he talked me into writing it. A friend of his, the guy who the Peter character is based on, was killed in somewhat suspicious circumstances a couple of years ago. And a lot of people connected to the energy industry in Russia have been killed in suspicious circumstances over the last few years. Some of them more obviously homicides than not. Peter's death, it's really an open question as to whether or not it was actually just an accident. He died in a helicopter crash. But so this fellow, John, wanted to tell someone his story. He read my first novel, which I guess had just come out at the time. Maybe it was the second one. I don't know. This was all pretty recent. But so is my first novel. So he contacted me and said he had an interesting story to tell me, and he thought maybe I would be interested in hearing it, which I was. And so he told me the story that is the basis for the novel, which is about going to Russia in the 90s, in between communism and Putinism, I guess you would say, when the country was moving from state ownership of all the industries to private ownership of all the industries. And the process of privatization was a big opportunity for a lot of investors who were willing to take a chance on doing business in Russia, which was a very dubious prospect at the time. Not a lot of people were interested in risking any money in the former Soviet Union, because the, you know, inflation was crazy. No one knew who really owned anything. The government managers who had been running a lot of the companies had sort of taken de facto ownership of some of them. And meanwhile, these vouchers, privatization vouchers, which is really the central idea of the book, were being issued. These vouchers allowed private citizens to then convert those to stock, to ownership in all of these formerly state-owned industries as they were privatized. Every Russian citizen was issued with vouchers, which you could then turn into private ownership of formerly state-run companies. And most of them weren't interested. They were thinking about how they were going to, you know, put a meal on the table when groceries were difficult to obtain and extremely expensive. And so a few investors like John went to Russia and bought up a lot of these vouchers for hard currency, which was, it was sort of a mutually beneficial transaction, because Russia needed hard currency very badly. And these investors were willing to take a risk that these vouchers would end up being worth something at a time when it wasn't at all clear that they ever would be. But the problem is that some of the former managers of these companies, the Soviet apparatchiks who were running things, didn't like the idea of losing control of the companies, not to Russian private citizens and certainly not to foreign investors. So there were, you know, a lot of threats involved to try to get these Westerners. John was an American. Peter was Czech. Peter was based on a couple people, but they were all Czech, actually. trying to get them out of the market. So there were a lot of death threats and a lot of nefarious stuff going on, and things worked out in the end, but it was a very exciting time. And it really was very much like the Wild West. The laws weren't being enforced such as they were, and it was sort of a gray area as to what was and wasn't legal at the time in a lot of cases in Russia. So
right. One thing that is an interesting point early in the novel is when the character of Peter Kovac from the Czech Republic is describing, in a sense, what happened in his own country and how differently this was playing out in Russia. And at one point, you have that character saying that they, meaning the Russians, don't have Václav Havel or Lech Walesa. They have a government they don't respect, no clear authority, no sense of pulling together for a new beginning. They felt screwed. Is that a fairly limited perspective, or is that a widely held opinion among Russians at this point in time?
I think it was a pretty widely held opinion. Certainly there was, you know, in the West, we tend to think very well of Gorbachev, but he was reviled, so far as I can tell, by most average Russians for, you know, destroying their place in the world and throwing them onto the public market, so to speak, of being not being a global superpower anymore, but just being another country trying to make its way in the free market. And things nominally got a lot freer, and certainly there was more political influence than there had been under communism, but things were in a pretty bad state. You had tanks approaching the Kremlin. You had Yeltsin, who was, certainly an improvement democracy-wise on the communist regime, but not everything all Russians could have asked for. When you compare that to some of the post-Soviet countries, Poland or the Czech Republic, where the transition had been much smoother because it had been the result of local opposition to the communist government rather than really external political influence. Poland and East Germany and Hungary and the Czech Republic, or with Czechoslovakia as it then was, had all their independence movements, while Russia was sort of the bear keeping everyone in line, frightening everyone. And so they had a very different transition to the free market.
The two main characters, particularly at the outset of the novel, are John Mills, based very specifically on a figure, and then Peter Kovach, also based on a real person, or I guess a couple of different people. And it's interesting the contrast that you draw between them right at the outset as they first meet, kind of by accident in London. John Mills, you describe as a born and bred capitalist, a multinational investor, and sick of it at this point in time. Whereas Peter Kovach, born and bred socialist, who had recently taken the plunge into new free markets in his home country, and of course is incredibly excited about it. And it's just so interesting to think about these two characters being at two very different places in their lives and kind of seeing this in very different ways. For Peter, this is a new adventure that he's just begun. And for John Mills, maybe this is an opportunity to breathe new life into a career that for him had become kind of stale and stagnant and not appealing whatsoever. Was it hard to come up with this dynamic between these two characters, or was it kind of served you on a silver platter because that's who these two men were?
Yeah, in a sense, it was served to me on a silver platter. Because that was really the circumstance. You had on the one hand, people in Eastern Europe who were very excited to take their first steps into free markets, and on the other hand, bankers who've been in free markets all their lives, and it wasn't really big news. But what was big news was that you had this Wild West, the sort of gold rush going on in Russia, and it gave them a chance to do something a little more exciting than they were accustomed to, working at international banking for many years. But the position that Peter, the Peters, the people who made up Peter, were coming to versus John really couldn't have been more different. One of them was actually being recruited actively by the Czech secret police when Czechoslovakia stopped being a communist country. So he had just been trying to figure out how to get out of being sort of forcibly recruited into the Czech Stasi when he had this opportunity to go into buying up vouchers in the Czech Republic. It was one of the first countries where they tried these privatization vouchers, and it had gone very successfully. And I think, the Czechoslovakia is the model for how a country would ideally stop being communist. Everything was very smooth. And then, of course, the Czechs and the Slovaks separated on very good terms. When you compare that to, the Balkans a few years later, things couldn't conceivably have been more different. So he was, these guys who were Czechs were coming to Russia with a much more optimistic idea of how communism could transition to capitalism versus the Russians themselves.
Talk us through kind of what you thought about in terms of shaping the specifics of this novel and how much to adhere to the historic record. I mean, of what really happened versus taking kind of poetic license and making it perhaps an even more exciting story than the original story, how it played out. And even to matters such as the central company that we talk about, which in your novel is Gazneft, which I think is not a real company, but based on an actual company. I mean, what sort of considerations did you think about in terms of what sort of reality to retain versus what to fictionalize?
Well, there was so much real material to work with, just really good, dramatic, novelistic, real events to work with, that it was more a question of seeing what I could fit into a novel. Obviously, this took place, the transition from communism to capitalism, then the privatization of all the companies, took place over a much longer time frame than I was able to work with in the novel. You know, in a novel, you've got to keep everything moving and you've got to keep it pretty dense. So it was really more a question of trimming everything down and fitting it together in the most easily digestible way. But most of the events really happened, or at least were based on things that really happened. And there are just a lot of fantastic anecdotes that I wasn't able to work into the novel just because I didn't have room for them. Because everyone I talked to about the book, John was the first guy I talked to, but I talked to some of the people who the Peters were based on, and various other people who appear actually as real characters in the story, some of the club owners in Moscow and the bankers. And every one of them had dozens and dozens of fascinating, extremely exciting stories about life in the 90s in Russia. I mean, it was like living in Deadwood or Tombstone. Things were happening constantly. And, you know, I could have written 10 novels just out of the stories they told me about various things. And it's kind of tempting to. Maybe if this one does well, there'll be another one.
Right. And you say in your author's foreword or preface, I forget how you call it, but that when we read this novel, some of the most kind of outrageous seeming events that one might assume were dreamed up by you as the novelist, in fact, were real. I mean, you're kind of leaving it unclear to us as the readers what is based on reality and what was not, but you really encourage the reader not to assume that kind of the craziest moments in this story aren't in fact based on crazy things that actually happened.
Yeah. And certainly the craziness was not in short supply. Like there's a sort of a subplot about the owner of what was at the time the most popular nightclub in Moscow being almost kidnapped. There was an attempted kidnapping, and he was sort of hiring ex-KGB guys to act as security because his Chechen business partners were trying to assassinate him. All of that was real. That's really exactly how it happened, as described in the novel. And he's a fascinating guy. His name is Doug Steele. He's one of the his real name appears in the book because he has such a sort of a devil may care attitude about all this stuff that he was one of the few people who didn't care if his name was changed for the novel. So he's actually in there, and that the Hungry Duck was really his club, and all the stuff described in this absolutely crazy club was real. And the Caspian Sea story, I think, is the other one mentioned at the beginning of the book. There is one of the guys who was based on Peter told me about being sort of shanghaied onto a fishing trip on the Caspian Sea, where he was expecting to go fishing for sturgeon, and then found out that what they were actually doing was that they were going to be having gun competitions. They weren't going to be having shootouts, but they were very heavily armed. They had boxes of old Soviet SKSs and AK-47s and RPGs. And they were just going to go up to fishing boats and take their fish. And then that was how the people involved went about fishing. They would just go up to commercial fishing boats and take all of their sturgeon, or however many they wanted. And so he thought that this was going to be, there were going to be shootouts on the Caspian Sea as they robbed people pirate-wise, pirate style. But actually it was much more organized than that. They would go up to a fishing boat. The fishing boat would produce all of its guns. And they were all pretty heavily armed too, apparently, and lay them out on the deck. And these guys who were stealing the fish would lay out their guns, and whoever had more got the fish.
Wow.
It was very tidily organized. No one needed to be shot. But that's just one of the things that if I read it in a novel, I would probably dismiss it as a rather silly story that didn't ring too true, but it really happened. So, no short supply of these stories.
Right. At one point, this period in Russian history, when they are just trying to shift over to something resembling capitalism, it's described as not only a free market, but probably the freest market in the world. Explain what's behind those intriguing words.
Well, it was the freest market in the world in the sense that there was really no functional regulation. It was a free market in the same sense that that California was a really free market during the gold rush, or the West was a really free market right after the Louisiana Purchase, when people were just going out and homesteading and making their lives. No one was running things. There was really no central authority at all in Russia at the time. There were policemen and there were soldiers, but they were widely regarded to be extremely corrupt. Nothing was really being enforced. Certainly nothing was being enforced in an organized way. And there was a lot of bribery going on. And so in as much as in a free market, you can buy and sell commodities. One of the commodities being sold was the control over the rule of law in any particular local area. So that was, you know, it was, I won't say a libertarian paradise, but it was sort of a free market in the same way Somalia is a free market.
Mm. Well, and what a promising backdrop for a really exciting novel, which, of course, your book is, The Siberia Job. A last question. Again, your main protagonist, John Mills, is based very closely on John Kleinheinz and his experiences. Did you, the two of you, actually collaborate in the writing of this novel, and or at any point were you, in a sense, showing him the novel and wanting his approval? Or was it not a partnership in that respect?
We didn't write together, but I did show him the novel a couple times while I was working on it, just more so he could tell me, you know, this is factually right. This is, you've got this wrong. You know, because the finances of it are all very complicated, and I have no particular background in international finance, whereas he does. So he was sort of the fact checker on a lot of this stuff. And I just, you know, I wanted to make sure that I got the atmosphere right and everything. So there was a lot of collaboration in that sense. We didn't write together, but we've been in pretty close touch. And he's a very, very interesting guy. He's a very nice guy. He had me out to his house on in the Bahamas, which was kind of funny because I was there when I was there interviewing him when I sold my previous novel, Fake Money, Blue Smoke, which is published by the same press, Mysterious Press. I was actually with him when I got the call from my agent that the novel had sold. And so, you know, he said we should go celebrate. And what we ended up doing was going to the mansion from Thunderball, the Sean Connery, James Bond movie. I don't know if you remember that.
Wow.
No, it's... It's in the movie, it's called Palmyra. It's got a shark swimming pool, you know, the famous shark swimming pool. But now the mansion is completely abandoned. It's a derelict on the north coast of Nassau because it's in an extremely dangerous neighborhood, very, very high murder rate neighborhood. And so just no one lives there. It's completely abandoned. And I had heard about that. And he said, well, let's just go check it out. And so we drove over there and sort of walked under the chain fence and had a look around. The shark swimming pool is still there. So it was a good time. So really writing this process from start to finish has been pretty exciting. In fact, the process of writing the novel would probably make a pretty good novel.
Wow. Very good. Well, we leave it to our listeners to explore the novel on their own and all the wonderful specifics that are part of this really exciting story set in such an exciting, turbulent point in Russian history. The novel, again, is titled The Siberia Job, published by the Mysterious Press, and the author, Josh Haven. Josh Haven, thank you so much for making time for this interview, and congrats on writing a really exciting novel. We look forward to your further work. And again, thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thanks. Thanks very much for having me.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Now for part two of today's program, we hear from yet another novelist about yet another novel set in and around Russia in the mid-1990s. This conversation was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2018. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking with a very talented Swedish writer by the name of Martin Österdahl. He's actually been an award-winning director for a number of years, but now is taking on new undertakings as a writer, and
very obviously a gifted one. The book that we're going to be talking about, a novel called Ask No Mercy, the first in a series of books around a character named Max Enger, has been a huge success in Sweden and in areas beyond, and as a matter of fact is soon going to be transformed into a major television series. And one of the things that makes this book particularly interesting is because it largely involves the nation of Russia, where the author, Martin Østerdahl, spent some years studying. And so he has long been intrigued by the nation of Russia, and particularly the volatile period of the mid to late 1990s. And that is the time period in which this thriller is based. And this novel has recently been translated into English and is now available to American readers. And I'm excited about the possibility of talking now with Martin Østerdahl about Ask No Mercy, published by Amazon. And Martin Østerdahl, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, tell us about your career ahead of being a writer. Explain to us the kind of things that you have directed and the ways in which that earlier work has led to this new undertaking for you.
Well, I started out working in media and media management, and then I started producing television shows. And most of the television shows I've been involved in have been entertainment shows, so music, big sort of music-based entertainment shows, which, you know, quite different from writing novels, obviously. But I've also worked a lot with as a director of television at the national TV station SVT in Sweden, and of course overseeing production of all sorts of genre. And I guess that at the bottom of it all lies a great interest and passion for storytelling. And, you know, no matter what kind of TV shows or books you produce, the heart of the matter is always a great story.
Hmm. So what was it that brought you to Russia, where you did some studying? First of all, what age were you at the time, and what exactly were you studying, and why in Russia?
Well, my first experience with the East was when I was at school. As a young boy, I was fortunate enough to go to a special music school, so I did a lot of singing. I sang at the Royal Opera House in Stockholm, and we traveled with the choir, with the opera choir, to behind the Iron Curtain, as it was at the time. So I got to tour in East Berlin, in the Czech Republic, and in Hungary, places like that, which was something that not many people in my age was able to do, obviously, because during this time, Europe was sealed, and that part of Europe was sealed. Europe was divided in two halves. But I was brought up in Sweden, which belonged to the western side, and I also grew up in England, where my father lives. So I was very, very amazed by how different life was behind the Iron Curtain. And when I was there, I was, you know, we were taught from an early age that this was the enemy. This was, you know, the opposition in the Cold War. But the people that I met were so fascinating, so full of life, and so incredibly hospitable to us. And so it woke my curiosity to try and understand, you know, how can we be so different, but at the same time so similar? So I think from that very early age, I decided that I had to try and understand all of this and try and understand Europe.
So what was the experience like to actually go to school for a time in Russia and, I believe, finish your master's thesis, actually?
Mm. Yeah, so I decided there and then that if you're going to understand, you know, Europe and Eastern Europe and Russia, you probably need to learn the language and you need to spend some time in Russia. So at university level, I studied Russian and I spent some time in Moscow first and then in St. Petersburg. And that was the part where the book is based, which was mid-90s, 1996, to be more precise, was the time of the watershed presidential election when Boris Yeltsin managed, against all odds, to come back from a pretty bleak position in the opinion polls to win the election. You know, this was a time when Russia was pretty much lawless, and there was a lot of tension in the air, and everyone actually believed that the Communist Party, then led by a man called Zhuganov, was going to win that election. So everyone was sort of fearing that this very brief period of openness and democracy was going to end after only 5 years. But somehow, Yeltsin managed to win with the help of Western forces, but also with the help of the oligarchs. And this, of course, is the social sort of backdrop to Ask No Mercy. And there's a lot of interesting things happened in this election that actually hasn't been written about so much. So I was fortunate enough to be there in St. Petersburg when it happened. And later on, I decided to write this down in the novel.
So exactly how long has this novel, in a sense, been percolating, been sort of beneath the surface of your life, sort of waiting to finally be shaped?
Quite a long time, to be honest. It started out, actually, when I lived in New York for a while, and I lived there during the attacks of World Trade Center, 9/11.
Wow.
So my first attempt at writing this story actually started the days after 9/11, when I lived in my Manhattan apartment, and I had experienced the terrible catastrophe firsthand. I mean, we lived close to World Trade Center. We lived beneath the line that was sealed off for a few weeks or months after. And everything stopped. Everything stopped in New York, people just, especially us expats from the UK or from Sweden, we just sort of, we sat in cafes and talked and tried to understand what had happened. And for me, I felt this great urge to just sit down and write, to try and understand what was going on. And my thoughts traveled back to Russia and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Soviet Union, because that, up until 9/11, was the biggest sort of historic event of my life. And it certainly formed my upbringing and my understanding of the world. So there I was on Manhattan writing about the collapse of the Soviet Union, pretty much. And that turned out to eventually, 15 years later, it became Ask No Mercy.
We're speaking with Martin Østerdahl, and his first novel is indeed titled Ask No Mercy. It was a enormous bestseller in Sweden and has been published elsewhere as well. It is just now published in a new English translation by Peter Sean Woltemad and available now to American listeners. So I want you to talk about your main character, Max Anger. And one of the things I also want to confess as an out-of-touch American is that as I'm kind of thinking about the life of this man named Max Anger, it makes me realize that I think most Americans never stop to think about a nation like Sweden being engaged in intelligence and counterintelligence and espionage and that kind of thing. I think we often tend to think of that as something that only the superpowers are engaged in. I mean, not that Sweden isn't a perfectly significant country in some respects, but it's not a superpower in that respect, of course. What can you tell us about this kind of activity in a nation like Sweden?
Well, I mean, to Swedes, and in Sweden, especially Russia, has always been considered the arch enemy, and this goes back way, way back into history. If you take Max Anger, the protagonist of the book, he's raised on an island called Arholma outside of Stockholm, in the archipelago of Stockholm. Stockholm is surrounded by about 30,000 islands, and Arholma is one of them. If you go to this island today, you'll find that at the northern tip of it, there's a huge military base. It's abandoned now, but it's a gigantic sort of construction inside the mountain. And at the top of the mountain is a huge cannon pointing to the east. And it's still there if you want to go and see it.
Wow.
And also, if you walk around the cliffs of this island, you'll find inscriptions in the stones from the time when Peter the Great invaded the island in the 1700s and put the whole island on fire. So to the people on the coast, on the east coast of Sweden especially, there's always been an awareness that on the other side of that sea is the gigantic country of Russia, and it's always in our history been our arch enemy. So we've always had to keep an eye. There's a saying that goes around in those areas that if you're from there, you always sleep with one eye open, and it's always open to the east.
Mm. So one way in which the nation of Sweden has its collective eye open to the east is through a think tank called Vector, which does perpetual research on Russia in order to understand what they might be doing. And your main character works for Vector, as does a woman who eventually disappears. Tell us more about their relationships and the mysterious circumstances of her disappearance.
Well, they're a couple, and I think they were united in many things. But one of the things that they really both stand very firmly for is the freedom of everyone to live a free life. And Pashi, as she's called, the Russian girl that Max is in love with, she is from Russia. She's from an area of the Ukraine, actually called she's a Tatar, so she's in the minority, a Russian minority. And of course, in recent years, when this book was actually eventually published, what happened was that Putin and Russia invaded that part of the Ukraine and reclaimed it as Russian territory. This is Crimea, as I'm sure you're aware. And she has a personal history of having her grandfather being taken away one morning by Stalin, as so many minorities were, to be deported somewhere to do pretty much slave labor in some gigantic infrastructure project somewhere in the Soviet Empire, and this is something that has really plagued her upbringing, and she's fighting for the freedom of all Russian people, and in that she's very much united in Max, because Max has a similar kind of background with a very mysterious family situation. He doesn't know who is. Grandparents are. All he knows is that his father was placed on this small island called Arholm outside of Stockholm, but beyond that he doesn't know anything. He doesn't know who his grandparents were and how it happened that his father was placed there as a foster child. So he's trying to sort of dig into the past and find out who he really is, and Pashi is doing the same. So that those two things really sort of unite the two of them. And of course at the outset of this book, Max has tried to dig deeper into what happened to his father and his grandparents. And as he does that, suddenly Pashi goes missing in St. Petersburg. Because she's working for Vector in St. Petersburg, and he's working in Stockholm. So he sets off to try and find her. And obviously, he senses that there might be a connection to his mysterious family past and the reasons why she has been kidnapped.
Right. And, of course, it's especially frightening and difficult for him to be undertaking this search in a place like Russia.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially at the time, because there's no one you can trust. It's not like you can go, you can't go to the Swedish consulate or the Swedish embassy. You can't go to the police, you know, heaven forbid. So basically you have to go and look for yourself, and that's what he does.
Mm. I love the way that journey is painted with ominous signs at every turn. It's marvelously crafted. I want to be sure to ask you a question kind of on behalf of all Americans. When we think about a nation like Russia, which of course is very much in the news and has been over the last couple of years, chiefly for the very, very clear evidence indicating that Russian operatives were very directly involved in our most recent presidential election, and of course certain matters that are currently under investigation. I think Russia, as you said at the outset, is one of those nations that has a certain sort of mystique about it, and we view them very warily and also tend to view them with grave suspicion, yet fascination and intrigue. Mm. How do you think, how would you advise us as Americans to sort of think about the nation of Russia? And how different is the Russia of today from the Russia that you are describing in your novel?
Wow, that's a big question. I think as far as advice is concerned, I think the picture that's often portrayed of Russia in media is a simplified one. I think what one has to realize that Russia is an enormous country. It's pretty much, you know, like a world in itself. And there are so many different Russias, so many different Russian people as well. And of course, I think to anyone who really wants to increase their knowledge and understanding of Russia and the world, history is a good place to look and to try and look deeper than what you might find in the daily newspapers. And also in popular culture, you quite often tend to find quite sort of single dimension descriptions of Russians. But it's a very complicated country. The time of the 90s, in which my book is taking place, was a very positive time period in many ways, because, you know, with the fall of the Soviet Union and with Gorbachev, who started it all with his perestroika and his glasnost, the openness to the West, I think we all felt a sense of opening and a sense of near, you know, a nearing of Russia and Europe and the West, which was, it was really a time of great optimism, but also great concern. I mean, in this part of the world, in Sweden and Scandinavia, we were very concerned that the Russians would just, you know, come in hundreds of thousands and leave this poor country that had collapsed and immigrate to our countries in huge volumes. Of course, that never happened, and the reason for that is that the Russians are very proud and they love their homeland, they love their country and their culture very, very much, and they consider themselves to be a high culture, you know, one of the high cultures of the world, and the fascination with Russia is something that we all in Sweden we very much feel. It's not only that we fear them and consider them the arch enemy; we're also very fascinated of their high culture. They're enormously successful and prolific in sports, in all forms of arts and entertainment and literature and so on. So there's a lot to admire about the Russians, and they are very patriotic. So they never did leave the Russian soil in any great numbers, and they do love Mother Russia, and there are a lot of explanations for why, but the culture is very different from the rest of Europe.
Hmm. Well, it's a beautifully crafted novel. I am most impressed. As I read it, I kept sort of exclaiming to myself in wonder that this is your first novel, and clearly all of your work as a director over the years has taught you a lot about what it means to tell a good story, what it means to entertain, and your novel is certainly all of that and more. I assume you are very excited at the prospect of it taking shape as a series for television as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that is a dream come true. Yeah, I'm very excited about it.
The novel, again, is Ask No Mercy. It is published by Amazon Running, and the author, Martin Østerdahl. Martin Østerdahl, I enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you, and I wish you well with all of your future endeavors.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on the podcast version of The Morning Show, entertainment legend Steve Allen in a recording from 1999, an interview I conducted in tandem with then WGTD News Director Bill Guy. Next week, the broadcast of the morning show will include on Monday an interview that was supposed to air last Monday with attorney James Kwok, author of The Fear of Too Much Justice.